The facade of the American dream.
How the Healing Community Center came into being was a result of my working at Grady Health System. That's a hospital in Atlanta. I would see folks that come in with cancers of their jaw or of their voice box, and the cancers had gotten to such an extent that they really had no treatment options. And there was just very little that we could do other than put in a tracheotomy, an airway, and try and get them whatever care we could. And seeing that over and over again, month after month and year after year, each time I would say to myself, you know, somebody needs to do something about this. And then one day I just realized that maybe it was supposed to be me. We're now in an 8,000 square feet facility that we provide general medical care, pediatrics, ENT, audiology, and dental program. And all of our services we provide free of charge. How we're able to do that, we partner with academic institutions, with private institutions, and with community organizations and private practitioners and just general folks in the community that want to come out and make a difference. We see primarily hypertension, high blood pressure, diabetes, and oral health issues are top three. We also see a significant amount of HIV, and all of those, we make a concerted effort to address those issues.
That's the information that I wanted to pass on to you. The new date is June 29th, 5 to 7 p.m. Thank you for being a volunteer. Bye-bye.
That's a problem, right, Maya? I think that's what she was concerned about when we was on the date and she hadn't voted. She was. I guess what?
Is there a difference between African American and Caucasian patients in regards to their health? I think the difference really is based upon socioeconomic status, and that in impoverished areas, which in most places in the United States tend to primarily have African Americans and Latinas, there's a lack of resources, there's a lack of access to medical care. A lot of folks in underserved areas, there really is no access to health care. For example, we are currently at the Healing Community Center doing outreach to bring health care out to folks. There are several apartment complexes within the city of Atlanta where folks have lived there all their lives and really have not been more than 5 miles outside of that apartment complex. In order to get to grocery stores, they have to rely on someone from the community that has a car. One apartment complex in particular has now about 92% unemployment. At our previous location, we checked. The nearest grocery store was a 20-minute bus ride each way. And if you have a family, you have to get on the bus, and if you have kids, and then try and do all of that, and then get back on the bus, which you've waited for whatever period of time, with all your bags, with your kids, and then try to get home, you're really not going to try to do that very often. You're going to try to look for other options that will allow you to survive. So what we have done is that we have started partnering with the stores that are nearby. We're also looking at creating a system through collaborating with the faith-based organizations that will provide a ride system for folks so that they can actually have access to get those healthy options, as well as provide mobile grocers that will come in with green vegetables and fruits on a truck at certain days at certain locations to give people other options.
The stress of racism, current day racism, causes problems. So I actually think integration may be one of the big issues, because one of the big stressors is working in a historically white institution.
We do have, as white people, a system of privilege. It may be relative privilege.
And there's been several articles about this, about the stress of being middle class in a white institution. And so now you've got this body, you've got this history, and now you've got this body that's under stress. You get illnesses.
Primary things that people brought to our attention was that they needed to have some outlet for stress. You know, when you're faced with not having a lot of opportunities, not having really great aspects for decent jobs, not having really affordable or decent housing, all of that is going to be stressful.
When you hold out the promise for white people that regardless, they still have the potential and opportunity to rise, to be the overseer, to be the boss, that there is nothing structural inherently, seemingly, that keeps them down. They internalize that, and they are willing to live with that.
It takes a serious toll on you psychologically as well as physically. The amount of stress that creates, constant worrying, constant trying to figure out if you're good enough, you know, if it's you that's the problem, trying to reconcile that daily, for me, it led to physical problems, gastrointestinal, urinary issues that I'm still dealing with to this day. It's a feeling that every day I'm feeling just knots in my stomach. I've had to have surgery on parts of my body that I shouldn't, like, for my age, I should not be dealing with right now. That there was the connection that there are clear effects,
your psyche or your inner strength being repetitively beaten down as a result of those types of attacks. If you're not someone that is really grounded and know that, you know, I'm someone of value, I'm someone of worth, if you're not that way, if I hadn't been raised by my parents to be an independent thinker and to know that no matter what anybody says, I have value. You're just demolished.
You cannot rise above this virtual barbed wire that encloses you or the jackboot that is inherently on your throat.
You think, you know, why even try? Why even try? If just because of the way I was born and the way I look, certain things are going to be assumed that I have done those things, or that I have limitations just because of the color of my skin, which, you know, doesn't mean anything.
Everything saying this is institutional racism, this is white supremacy.
And I can understand that, because if you're just beaten down day after day and you never see the light of day.
The CIA, I love precisely because, you know, CIA has said that the measure of the quality of life of a people can be, you can measure that quality of life by the life expectancy in the country.
Do I think it's more stressful to be an African American? Yes.
Not only do we see that the life expectancy of African American men is 7 to 8 years shorter than the life expectancy of white men. And there's a similar gap, not quite as wide for women, it's more like 5 or 6.
We've gone out and talked to people in our community, asked them what things that they felt were most important to them. And they stated that they were stressed about not having jobs, stressed about not having good educational systems they felt for their kids.
Middle-class black Americans who have babies have more lower birth weight babies than white women without an education. Health of a mother affects the health of the child. No one's going to argue that. That means my son's health was impacted by my health. My health was impacted by my mother's health. My mother's health was impacted by my grandmother and so forth. That means every generation coming through has an impact on the health of the child. So when you look at our statistics as a black American and you put it in a life chart with countries, we are so low that we are in countries that are second and third world countries.
We have a criminal justice system where a number of African American men are either uninsured or underinsured, and the first time they actually will see a doctor will be within the confines of a prison or a jail. And that's where they will receive their first physical exam, their first dental exam, and probably upon release will be estranged from the healthcare system.
Driving through South Bronx with my family, I'm not sure if we were, I think we actually had gotten lost because my uncle lived in Queens, but it looked like a war zone. It completely devastated landscape, poverty-stricken population, and it was horrific seeing that in a country that, you know, you envisage as being this great bastion of wealth and equality where everyone is more or less on the same plane.
And they moved out of the suburbs, they moved out of the inner cities, and the only ones that were left behind were those that couldn't get out. And meanwhile, the jobs went to the suburbs also. And so you had the people left behind in a community that was devastated. This population has no connection to the economy, and they represent a potential revolutionary source because they have to be controlled.
Seeing this incredible contrast between that perception and how the reality of it on the ground, would have, you know, knocked me for a loop no matter what, I feel, no matter how old I was, particularly since I didn't have that way to put it in context.
Well, there is a disparity in income and wealth between white Americans and African Americans. Wealth is the easiest thing to address. It's not because we didn't try. Certainly it's ironic for people who brought Africans to the United States or to America to work and now accuse the descendants of African Americans as being lazy.
If you truly believe that a group of people are inherently inferior, why do you have to constantly harp on it? Inherently means they can't do nothing. You can get everyone, single one of them, a degree from a big university, and they can't do nothing because they are inherently inferior. If you really believe that, you don't have to sweat it.
The wealth that was produced in the United States came from two factors. One, the land was stolen from the Native Americans, and two, the labor was stolen from Africans.
They fear our potential, our possibilities. And they have created this image of us that they have scared themselves. They have scared themselves.
Basically, the political system prevented blacks from owning wealth and even owning land and housing in the District of Columbia as recently as the 1950s.
I cannot believe that considering what we have done to these people, that they not always plotting to get back at us. I cannot believe that they just want to, you know, kind of live in harmony with us. No. That ain't, because this is the way they think. That's not, no. They want to get back at us.
America had Reconstruction for 1.5 years. They, right after the Civil War, they passed a Reconstruction law. Yes, we know everybody's in bad health and we know everybody has no education. So what we're going to do is do things to give them good health, do things to educate them. Pass the law. How long the law was on the book? 1 year. Why? Because it took money. And they didn't want to take the money. The North didn't want to pay for it. The North was sort of like, hey, we're not the ones who had slaves. And the North was also interested in not making the South angry. And the only way to pay for it would have been to take the land from the Southern farmers, sell it off, and use it to do reparations for blacks. So none of that happened when it should have happened, and all of the pain is passed through. So you can look at all the studies and you can see the buried health problems being passed on generation by generation.
In the beginning stages of Section 8, and I don't even remember how long this has been out there, maybe 20 years, Section 8 did not allow the male component to be in the household. So it was for single families, single women raising a household without a man involved. And she could lose her certificate, her voucher, if a male was found in the home.
A male-dominant family was not something that was valued by the dominant culture.
It made it seem as if the government was her man. The government was her provider. And she could take money on the side from the guy, and a lot of women did. They didn't record it, but in terms of actually being recorded that he was the man of the house and he was actually taking care of the family, no, he was non-existent because she wanted to keep that government money coming in there with the subsidized housing.
The culture in this country has done everything in its power to see to it that we remain subservient.
Think about it. We're living here in the District of Columbia. An average one-bedroom apartment now is running $900. Two bedrooms, $1,500 and up. So that means you gotta work. Most people are going to work to try and, you know, take care of themselves to pay that kind of rent. And the mortgages are even higher, and sometimes they're lower, you know. Whatever, if you're renting a house, you're going to pay even higher. But if you get a mortgage, then you might pay lower. But then you have all the other amenities associated with it. That means you got to work for a living. Well, think about it. You got these young girls out there who are saying, I don't have a job, okay, but I can make a baby. And when I make the baby, I can put my name on a list for housing. And when I get accepted for the list for housing, then I can get me a two-bedroom apartment that's worth $2,000, that's worth $1,500 for nothing. They have no incentive to get up off their feet and do anything. They're being paid to sit there and be stupid. They're being paid to sit there and be dependent.
We have accepted mediocrity. We have accepted, I mean, it used to be obviously when a young lady would get pregnant, they always used the phrase, they would send them down south. I made the point, if a child is 13, 14, 15 getting pregnant, I'm not throwing a baby shower. That ain't a party. But the other thing is, we also must confront those young men. I've called them pastors all across the country to say, you're not going to dedicate a child unless you make the effort to sit down and talk with the father and the mother. You're not going to marry somebody unless you deal with the bride and the groom. So why would you dedicate a baby if you haven't done that?
Unfortunately, in too many households, again, you aren't the parent or even the grandparent now. The grandparent may only be 25 or 30 years older than the grandchild. And so there's not enough history there to be passed down. So there's no other frame of reference of understanding.
Because the white power structure was so angry with the civil rights forces. So they destroyed the civil rights movement that we built with drugs and violence.
A lot of violence in our community and the things that we see going on keeps us at a certain level, so that we cannot progress at the magnitude that we need to. And therefore, a lot of people can say, look at them. You're looking at people out there any day. You're looking at people out there on the street in their 40s and 50s that are dependent on drugs and alcohol. And then you know 20 and 30 years ago what they were doing and how they were victims, some of them willingly participants in the drug trafficking and how it tore us down.
Most of our kids will not be going into the system. They will be going into the jails and prisons that are in fact enslavement camps in this country. The Rockefeller laws, which are now being taken from the books, take them from the books if you wish. What about my children, about hundreds of thousands that are upstate and all around the state in New York? Why haven't they been released? Why haven't they been rehabilitated and reintegrated into the society? Why haven't they not been given reparations for smoking some weed? My God, weed. That's all marijuana is. There's no evidence that it's harmful. Doesn't make sense to sit around the corner smoking it all day. But neither does it make sense for children to be thrown in jail for it. Here in New York, young kids on the way to school, young black males particularly, young brown males particularly, on the way to school, 9 and 10 years old, are thrown up against the wall by cops, their book bags taken from their shoulders, books tossed out, taken from their shoulders, tossed out. First day. Second day, they do the same. By the third day, the child does what? The child is ready to fight back.
My two sons who died from gun violence here in the District of Columbia were not associated with the drug trade. That's not the reason they died. Still, that whole mentality of violence, you know, was perpetrated, and just it's terrible. After my sons died, I had an opportunity to meet hundreds of mothers whose children died from gun violence here in the District of Columbia, and I had an opportunity to meet people probably I never would have seen in my life, never, because they weren't like me, and the stories that they told me about their childhood, how they were molested, how they were in foster care, how some of them married a lot of criminals and then they brought their criminal activity into their families, and some of them molested their own children. And this is some of the stories that I heard about them being prostitutes and you know, living on the street and being homeless, and the things that they told me. And then they're raising these children in these dysfunctional homes, and some of their children got into the bad behaviors of selling drugs or taking the drugs, and then it ended up in where some of them were either they were the killer or they're the ones to be killed.